and welcome to What Scream, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Grain, chats with a special guest every week about horror films. And in particular, we talk about two films that have to do with a certain subject or topic that I've previously randomly chosen. Now, this week's theme is animated horror. So we're not talking so much as like Nightmare Before Christmas or Coraline or anything like that. We're talking about adult animated horror. My guest this week is Russ Bailey, my good friend, who is also a senior contributor from Moving Pictures Film Club. And together we are chatting about two animated horrors. The first one is Mad God from 2021, written, produced and directed by Phil Tippett. And the second film we are talking about is The Spine of Night, again a 2021 animated horror film directed by Philip Gallat and Morgan Gallen King. So yes, enjoy this episode about animated horror.
So I would like to welcome to the podcast for the very first time. I'm super excited to have a co-senior contributor from Moving Pictures Film Club. Russell Bailey, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. Yeah, it's a sunny Wednesday where I am, so I'm all right. It's all very calm, and I'm excited to talk about two strange films.
Strange is the word. Before we get into them, would you like to introduce yourself and tell listeners who you are and what you do?
So I'm Russell. I am both a senior contributor for Moving Pictures Film Club, which I write articles, reviews. I do a video series, which is all about non-horror horrors. So those are kind of films that aren't technically horrors, but feel fairly terrifying or fairly like they could comfortably fit within the horror genre. And the rest of the time, I am a podcaster over at Not Just for Kids, which is a we look at family films and the films you grew up with. And right now we're doing modern animation, which I think ties nicely into today's theme.
Cool. So how did you get into horror, and what was the first horror film you ever saw?
So the first horror film I ever saw was Jaws. Jaws is one of the most impactful films I've ever seen. I saw that when I was about five, which I think is too young to watch Jaws. And I had 5 years of recurring nightmares of sharks. And I have never been comfortable in the sea, in large open bodies of water. And I'm always a bit trepidatious about nature because, for me, it's nature. So it's Jaws, I think. In terms of other films, like as a teenager, I got into... So when I was 11, I snuck in a watch of Predator, which is an 18. I'd asked my parents, they'd said no. Well, I'd asked my dad, he'd said no. So I went to a friend's house and watched it. And I got told off, but then my dad started lending me 18 certificated films, which tended to be sci-fi and sci-fi horror. So like I've watched like about 11 Aliens, Event Horizon, all those kind of odd 80s and 90s sci-fi horror. So yeah. So it's sort of Jaws, and then it's kind of like merged into being sort of quite a sci-fi horror bent.
I think I watched Jaws too late. I was too old when I watched Jaws, and I'm quite a water person. I love being in the water, so it's never bothered me. I've always been like, if I'm going to go by shark, grand. I'm feeding an animal, it's fine. So it's never really scared me all that much. So yeah, Jaws has never really affected me. I'm kind of sad.
I mean, it still gets me. It's still like the estuary scene in particular which is with the kids and the guy in the boat. It's, I think it's the first time you clearly see the shark. And it's like, I'm always terrified of that specific moment because they should be safe, but they're not.
Yeah. I, you know what? It's due a rewatch. Maybe I was just too much of a cynic back
but,
then.
I mean, it is creaky, and it is like, I've watched on the big screen several years ago now, and it was an old print. And so you could kind of feel the kind of creakiness of it, like where the special effects are dated because like they were not working at the time. So like, mm-hmm. I mean, the mastery of Jaws, you don't see the shark, but when you do see the shark, it's just this like giant rubbery thing flipping about on a boat. And it's like, well, that's not actually that scary. But it's just, yeah, that kind of fear I had as a kid watching this film has stayed with me. Like, yeah, it's like I feel like a good horror leaves like a thumbprint on you, like an Aardman model, and that one definitely pushed very far into my surface.
Where I live is like a coastal area, and they used to do films down at the cove where they put like a massive screen up and projector, and they played Jaws one of the years, and I just think that would be like the perfect setting like down at a beach to watch Jaws.
I've seen like screenings in swimming pools where you're on like floats watching Jaws, which I can't think of anything I'd less want to do. Maybe, going to cave and watch The Descent, that would also be a horrifying experience. But yeah, I don't think I need to be closer to the horror myself when it comes to these films that scare me.
You're like, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. So let's talk about our theme for this week, which is animation, animated horror. Now, I am completely ignorant of animated horror. I just didn't think it, I would find it scary or affected me. So I've always kind of been like, meh. What is your relationship like with animated horror? Are you a fan of it?
So I guess like running the pod that I do, I will sometimes tease away from family films. I'll try and get as close as I can. So my other love being horror, I try and get as close as I can to it. There is some family animation that gets close to it. Like obviously, I mean, Snow White famously got quite a strong rating because it's quite an intense, scary film in the cinema. And a lot of early animation delves into horror a bit. So, with Snow White, you've got the bit in the forest where the branches are trying to get to her, and that's quite intense. I mean, my daughter's fine with it. She's not fine with Dumbo. And I mean, so I guess there is some like early Disney feels like it's rich with horror within itself. And then that as they moved away with it, it became more of an indie filmmaker kind of thing. There are very few like core mainstream animated horrors out there because they don't make money, truthfully. They're hard to market because for so I guess the horror fan they'd rather watch something that's closer to reality, and for an animation fan or for a family film you can't watch it. And so but like there's been things like Paranorman, which is a fantastic example of and Leica in general are fantastic with their stop motion that are horror. Coraline is still utterly terrifying. And obviously saying they're not successful is very much from a Western perspective. There's a number of anime examples of horror, like Perfect Blue, like I forget the name of it now, but it's like there's a giant monster on the cover. It's from the 80s. It's very sexualized anime that I watched at university, and that was odd. And like kind of close to what the sadness is in terms of film. And I remember a film called Fears of the Dark, which was an anthology series, anthology film, which was short films around horror. And then I guess kind of with streaming becoming a booming thing, we get to where we are today, where we've got like these two examples that we're going to talk about today. There's been a few others. There's is it called I think it's called Our House on Netflix, which is this again another anthology of stop motion horror. And I think that because where animation is in itself, that because of the kind of dominance of Disney, Pixar, DreamWorks is less so, it's allowed studios to come out and bring out more horror. So I think we're getting to a place where animated horror feels more represented than it ever has done. And so, yeah, I mean, like today we've got two that are on Shudder, quite easy to find. There are several other examples out there. Yeah, I think that there's a kind of a sea change almost. I also think that these films are makeable in isolation. So you can make them as part of a team, but not have to be together as a team. And that is certainly something that's impacted cinema in general because of the pandemic has suddenly allowed this. So yeah, I think we're in a place where horror animation could become more of a thing than it was, which was the odd film that popped up at Fright Fest and then disappeared, which for about 15 years is what it was. And then before that point, it's a few indie creatives make it, and it's not a sustainable model for them. And you have to look to places like Japan or further afield to find these examples of creatives delving into horror in terms of animation.
I mean, I from my own perspective, it was more a relatability thing that obviously when I watch horror, I want to be able to relate. And how can I relate to, it's a very ignorant thing to say, but how can I relate to animated characters or an animated kind of situation? Maybe I'm just heartless. But I've always kind of like, like Disney, I've always looked at that and been like, yeah, I mean, you just have to look at Fantasia to be like, that is pure horror at
Yeah.
times. But I do think, so I watched Perfect Blue last year, and I was really surprised about how much it got me. And I just feel like perhaps as we see, because of streaming sites, as we see a trickle from, places like Japan, who do have a strong tradition of animated genres, that's going to trickle down into our Western culture. And perhaps we, like you said, we are going to start seeing more, especially, I mean, Junji Ito, Japanese Tales of the Macabre, has, was it last year or earlier this year, released on Netflix. And I did watch that, and that is grotesque and really gross. So that did got me. So I'm definitely being educated now, the more stuff that I'm seeing coming onto streaming sites. So as much as people give out about streaming sites, they do have their uses.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, like streaming is a blessing and a curse. I mean, it gives us freedom, certainly from my perspective as a someone who's got young kids. You can't go out fairly regularly. You can have a lot more options out there. And I think the thing of animation for me is it's quite a tactile format. So the only films that really make me cry are animated films. There's something about them that I find emotionally rich, which I think definitely would work. And one of the films I'm going to talk about today is probably one of the most horrifying films I've ever sat through twice now. So it's like, I do think that it's a medium that, when used the right way, is tactile and emotionally open, and can certainly represent things that are really hard to represent in a live action format.
Okay, so let's start on that film then. What a film. So would you like to introduce it and give us a synopsis if you can, please?
Yeah, so our first film is Mad God. Which is Phil Tibbett's 3-decade-long stop motion creation. So he's been making this for 30 years. And how to have a synopsis for this film? In short, it's about a figure who's known as an assassin wandering through a hellish apocalyptic warscape to deliver a bomb to a certain place. And him getting into that is might destroy the world. It's harsh to say, it's a plot light film. It's more of a mood piece than it is an intense narrative. I think our second film has more of a narrative to it, but even that I think is quite low on narrative. This is a piece that is a good example of what you can do with animation in terms of creating a mood and a feel and a vision of a world that's quite terrifying.
This film had been on my watch list for ages, and I just never got round to seeing it. But I, the buzz it created when it came out, everyone was like, this film is the weirdest shit you're gonna watch. Like, don't go into it high. Don't be eating any edibles. Go into it sober. It's stop motion, which I said on your podcast, I really like stop motion animation. I'm that typical emo kid that's like, I love Nightmare Before Christmas. And so when someone says stop motion, that's what you think of. You think of like Nightmare Before Christmas, or if you have a child of a certain age, you think of Shaun the Sheep. And
A
so
lot of the sheep.
going into this, you're like, I didn't, again, I sound so ignorant with this whole episode. I didn't know that kind of thing was possible with stop animation. Like, holy, I've never seen stop animation like that before. It is just so intricate and so detailed, and everything is so gross that I just think, like, in like a completely good way,
No.
that when it, like, obviously there's a story behind why it took him 30 years, which I'm sure we'll get into, but it blows my mind Perhaps because I have ADHD and I can't imagine concentrating that hard on anything, but it blows my mind that, you know, they've got to move these pieces little by little to get the shots. And this is just such an assault on, you know, the visual senses that you're like, I can't believe people would have the patience to do this.
Yeah. And like, so like with stop motion, I guess we will have kind of two sort of images in our head. One is the Nick Park, which is the Aardman, which is, you know, sort of claymation, big eyes, big nose, big features, very cartoony. And then there's the Henry Selick one, which is the Coralines, the Nightmare Before Christmases, then Wendells and Wilds. And they are more, I don't think realistic is the right term, but they're very clean and stylized and feel more rigid and brittle. Whereas in this, it's kind of this like world of fluids and pulsating things, and there's some live action stuff put in here, and there's it's just this kind of like, I would describe this world as moist in a way that I wouldn't describe any other kind of that's what it feels like to me. Yeah, it feels like this like kind of like you've doused it in liquid and it's dripping. It's no good way to describe what this thing looks like, but yeah. And it's like a hellscape being created in front of us that's clearly coming from this visionary director's mind that's completely different from the Aardman model or the Leica Henry Selick model that we're most familiar with. And it's like stop motion is a ridiculous endeavor. I've always said this on my podcast. I entirely admire it because it is one of the most ridiculous endeavors I've ever sat down and watched, because it takes years. It takes this take 30 years because it was one creative working with a rolling group of other creatives. Like people come in and out of this project, and it's just Phil Tippett's project. And like even an Aardman film takes 5 years from the first idea through to being released, and that's a studio putting everything into that 5-year project. Leica don't make any money. They are funded by Nike essentially, because their co-CEO is the dad of the other CEO and is the owner of Nike. So yeah, stop motion is a fascinating medium that has had very little like financial success, but it is probably one of the first ones that an animator might do, because you can see as kids can create these, they can create like a Lego style movie. I've watched like 4-year-olds create like Lego movies where they like change the blocks around, and it is that kind of freedom to move things around. It's just, it's time consuming, and at a feature length takes so much of your life to do. And in this case, because the vision of Mad God is so unapproachably Phil Tibbetts, I think that's the thing. I think this is quite an unapproachable film. I think that's what people get at when they say, don't go and hide, don't go and drunk. You have to watch this. It's like nothing you've ever seen, because this is like nothing I've ever seen. I've seen nothing like Mad God. I don't think we will again, because as I say, it's a 3-decade project that's doesn't really have a synopsis to it, that is just a series of scenes and visions that are just terrifying.
Yeah. I really love films that when you watch them, you know that's a labor of love. And going back and reading about Phil Tippett, the story behind why it took 30 years, I just think is fascinating and kind of endearing to the project as well. So he was doing RoboCop 2 at the time and was like, I want to do Mad God and do this. And then he was brought onto Jurassic Park. And the story is he was meant to be doing, because of his stop motion animation of Dinosaur, Steven Spielberg wanted him to do stop animation dinosaurs for Jurassic Park. But then obviously computer graphics started to kind of take off and Spielberg was like, I'm going to use this, but I'll use, you can oversee the project. And this was when Phil kind of went, okay, stop animation is dead. It's dying, or it's extinct, which was his phrase that he used with Spielberg. And he shelved it. And I think that is such a shame, because I don't think stop animation is ever going to go out of style, really.
Yeah, and it's just that, I guess, so obviously another famous creative behind stop motion is Ray Harryhausen, who's he didn't make stop motion singular films. He made them incorporated into live action. So before CGI, we got dinosaurs done that way. And I guess the story of Mad God is a story of this creative vision being impacted by the arrival of a new format that has become dominant and is used to a mixed extent. Like, there are some amazing CGI animated effects. There are some that are like The Rock and The Mummy Returns. So, you know, it's a good and a bad story. But yeah, and like, I guess with Phil Tippett, he is one of the natural heirs to Ray Harryhausen. It's just what he was creating at that time becomes immediately obsolete. But the story has a happy ending because Mad God is out there. You can watch it on Shudder. So he came back to this project. It's just like, you have a creative spark at a certain point, and sometimes the world moves away from that creative spark. And so you're standing there. And I guess in Phil Tippett's case, he shelved it so he could keep up with where the direction of travel went. And Jurassic Park is my favorite film ever made. I'm more than happy that those are CGI creations, because I don't think it has quite the same impact. Certainly wouldn't have created that kind of timeless quality had it been stop motion. But yeah, the story of Mad God is one of like coming at the wrong point in time. If come 5 years earlier, we would have maybe had Mad God 25 years ago. It might have been one of these things that could have been made and been one of the final practical stop motion affected films. And it might have changed a different spark. It might be the spark, because like, obviously Nightmare Before Christmas is a certain creative spark, because so many people love that and so many creatives love that, that that's kind of sort of inspired so many others to go off and make animations, and some of those are doing stop motion animations. So maybe it'd be Mad God would be talking about, maybe Mad God would be on all the merchandise that Disney sells. I can't see it having the same impact as Jack Skellington. I don't think the weird baby thing that keeps popping up is quite as impactful as Jack Skellington.
No, I think it's such an inspiring story, because it just goes to show that you may have an idea and it may be great, but it just might be in the wrong time. And that, you know, sometimes you do have to shelve these things and come back to it at a later date. Because if he had continued with it, there wouldn't have been a Shudder to distribute it. You know, as much as we were saying about streaming sites earlier, it almost felt like fate that it had to come at this later date for there to be a distribution for it, which I think is lovely. It's like a little fairy tale, isn't it, in this weird, grim, morbid world. Let's talk about the creature design, because obviously Phil Tippett is very well known for his creature designs, what he specialized in. These creatures, like, I want to know what's going on inside his head. Does he need therapy? Is he okay? Because, like, these creatures are mad. There's so many genitals as well, right?
Yeah.
So many genitals in this.
It's a bit like society at times. Yeah, like, the creatures are horrifying, and like, it's this perfect mix. What I admire about Mad God is it's not just what you're seeing, it's what you're hearing. So it's like, as a soundscape that is utterly horrifying, that fits so perfectly with the images that are being created in front of us. And so you'll have these like creatures come shuddering towards another creature and start hitting them, and then you can hear their wheezes and their moans and their groans and this whole scape of sound. And some of them are closer to humans than others, and so we actually do get humans, but the humans are all very gas masky or are surgeons. Like, there's a lot of surgeons or soldiers in gas masks. It's very much a vision that's seems built from where a World War One vision, in a not dissimilar way to there's a game series I played called Resistance, which is like, if aliens had come in the 1930s, it would be that we'd be fighting aliens as opposed to the Nazis. And there's a lot of gas masks in that. It just feels like that singular item, the gas mask, has such an impact on like dystopian visions of eternal wars. It's like, the creatures are terrifying and horrid, and different scopes and scales. Some are very small. Like, there's a bit early on where the assassin steps on these three warring gnomes who are having a fight, and he just steps on them. And so, like, it's like this world that has very small, very large, and medium sized figures, and they're all interacting. They're all on their different levels, and then they interact with each other. Yeah, they're all monstrous.
My favorite one was the Plague Doctor. I do love a good Plague Doctor. Like you were saying about the gas mask, I think plague masks are very striking and they definitely evoke kind of reactions from people. You just have to watch the Harbinger film. Yeah, everyone got freaked out about that Plague Doctor mask as well. And I love the way, and I'm sure perhaps because you did watch it a second time, you just pick up on different things and you notice. And I like when the plague creature came out, I wanted to stop it and just have a look at its design. So on your second watch, did you notice a lot more things? Is it something that you can rewatch and find new and exciting kind of details that you might have missed the first time?
It does, but it retains that kind of sense of I'm not quite sure what I'm watching. Like even on a second watch, I was still a bit like the horror that really impacts me is the horror I feel I shouldn't be watching. And I don't feel I should be watching Mad God. It feels like a vision from a hellscape from the future. And I don't feel I should be watching it. And that I think is for me the impact I have of it. And so there are details and nuances and you can pick out the blood and the gizzards more, like in that operate. I think for me, the standout scene that impacted me was the operating scene where the assassin gets captured and stripped of his uniform and then is operated on. It's like it, the sound and the feel of that and the weird baby thing coming out. And I'm like, what? There's a baby thing? What does this mean? I think it's the first time you watch it, it's just like, it's so hard to comprehend what this film is. And the second time you slightly more, like the second time I kind of got to my reading of it, which is that I think it's similar reading to The Spy in the Night, actually, that it's just about the eternal impact of violence and war on us and that it dehumanizes us. And that's why all the creations are so hellish, they're so dehumanized to such an extent. And that's what the point is. The point is to be horrified and to be repulsed. I should use that. Yeah, this is a repulsing film.
I got like when you were saying, oh, I shouldn't be watching this film, it makes me feel like it's a little bit of a cursed videotape. You know, like obviously if we didn't have streaming services and if you came across this on a VHS and you put this on, you were like, oh, I'm gonna die in a couple of days. Like this, it just feels like because it hasn't got, it's not plot or narrative heavy, it definitely feels like there's some sort of curse in there.
In
But
another
yeah,
similar way to like Skinamarink, which as much as I'm happy that everyone is watching, I'm kind of sad that Skinamarink isn't one of these films that kind of gets made, released, and then people discover it over decades. Like the positive and the negative of a streaming service is that something like Skinamarink should be discoverable, not like put on the front of a streaming platform given a big mass marketing push. Like Lake Mungo disappeared and was a YouTube thing, and Lake Mungo for me feels like a film I shouldn't watch. Like I feel like I'm watching this family go through a profound moment of grief, tinged with something far more horrifying. And yeah, I like from a financial perspective, it's great that Mad God is available and has can be shown in cinemas, can be seen on streaming. I think the Prince Charles are showing it in a couple of weeks again. Like I that's positive, but in its own way, yeah, it feels like it's a cursed video and you should just stumble on it like 2 in the morning on Channel 4 and be like, what is this? Like it has that kind of vibe to it. Like I probably should have said that earlier. Like there were, when I was growing up, there were a lot of TV shows that were on like BBC Three or Channel 4 late at night. Like I think it's called Monkey Dust, which if you've not seen, is mind-scrapingly weird and is tapping into like fears of urban life, but with a lot more murdering stuff. But yeah, like it feels like there's like another side to animation, which is like the late night distribution of short form animation, which is like TV shows got made that wouldn't otherwise be made and are not being made by streaming services now because they were weird and uncomfortable and a lot of them came out in the 2000s, and we were in a weird place in the 2000s. I'm sure you found that with the horror you've covered from the 2000s. It's all dark and depressing and unpleasant. We're all very angry. And maybe I think Mad God is like 15 years too late for me, and that I think it should be in the 2000s because the 2000s, we were concerned about war. We were concerned about our fellow man much more. And this is a nihilistic view of the world that. Like we get to like at the end where I think it's saying that war is eternal, that there will always be war, we'll always get to this point. And that's like a really nihilistic, downbeat way to go, is that, yeah, where we end up, we end up with the mad gods.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, what is your taking behind this? But I think you've hit the nail on the head there. Now, towards the end, there's this weird tonal shift.
We go into a brightly colourful place.
That shocked me. I was just like, what is going on? What is happening? Have I fallen asleep? What the hell? It's so strange because it comes so bright and colourful. And
yeah.
So what do you think, you know, you were saying about the eternal cycle of war and destruction. What do you think they said? Was he trying to be optimistic, maybe?
No, I don't think there's any optimism in this film for me. I think that there's, while we're not given it clearly, I think as a societal structure to the world of Mad God, and I think we've reached essentially the elites by the point we reached the colourful part of the film. I kind of wish the film had more of that kind of nuance to it. I kind of wish we weren't just... I think Mad God is brilliant, but I also think it's fairly repetitive for me. Like, it's very much like horrifying image after horrifying image. Once you've seen two or three of them, you get slightly... I mean, I don't think I get fully desensitized to it, but it's like, here's another one of Phil Tippett's terrifying vignettes. I think we get there, but I think that because my reading is that war is eternal, it's just that, like, the world needs to become more like what the colourful place is, but the colourful place feels protected in this film, and it feels like one that's difficult to get to. And because the rest of the world is so corrupted and so destroyed and so oozing and pussy and gloopy, and the colourful bit doesn't feel very gloopy, it feels quite tactile and quite contained and everything. It doesn't feel like it's crumbling in front of us. It feels protected. So yeah, I don't think there's an optimism to it, because I think that there's this built-in class structure. Like, we get the strange bit where there's the almost priest-like figure and the rows and rows and rows of soldiers doing some kind of ceremony to send the thing down to the core. And it feels like, with a film like this, you're kind of making your own interpretations as you go, because it doesn't hold your hand. It just presents this terrifying world. But the second time, I guess I could pull out more. What I think is that there is a structure to this world. There's a class system in place. There is an elite in the center of this, which is the bright, colorful, lovely bit. And everything else has become so destroyed and corrupted that it is the hellish visions we get from most of this film.
Yeah. So would you recommend Mad God to horror fans?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the most fascinating horror visions of the last decade, I think. Because, yeah, there's a purity here to this as a horror vision. This is auteur cinema at its purest. I think it's a great vision and a good film. Like, I think because it doesn't hold your hand, because it doesn't give you enough clues as to what is actually going on, what it all means, it slightly detracts from me. But I definitely think, also because it's readily available, it's like you can go onto Shudder and watch this, and it's 90 minutes long, and just because it is, in the same way that Skinamarink became one of these films talked about, this is a film talked about, so you should just watch it to kind of understand a vision of horror that's over there doing something very odd and disturbing.
I would definitely recommend it. I think it's a wonderful example of what animation can do that you wouldn't be able to really get from a live action horror film. And, you know, the fact that horror can present itself in so many different mediums. I think this is an absolute, like, top of the range. Like, if you're a fan of animation, if you're an animation student, even if you're not a horror fan, I think people should watch it. I think they should be showing this in like animation courses. I hope they do. I'm going to go back to my old college and be like, because my old college, that, have you heard of like the Book of Kells, the animation?
Is that Cartoon Saloon?
Yes. So that's all from my old college.
Amazing. Yeah. Cartoon Saloon are some perhaps the greatest animation studio working right now, I think.
So I really just want to go back to my old college and be like, here's a film. Good luck. But yeah, I definitely think it's one that needs to be shown in an academic sense, as well as people who are just into crazy, disgusting kind of visuals. I feel like this should be on the horror iceberg. Like, it's just as messed up as, like, the guinea pig films.
I mean, I haven't watched the guinea pig films. I have heard of them. I'm like, no, over there. That's not for me. I'll stick with Mad God instead. Yeah, no, I think, yeah, Mad God is like a vision of something else.
Okay, let's move on to this next film. I'm gonna have to get out my notes for this because I'm not gonna be able to do this from memory, trying to get the synopsis up. So now I have to say that Russell actually recommended both of these films because I was like, I have no clue. So you're heading this episode, basically. So this was your second recommendation. Which is also on Shudder, which is great. It is called The Spine of Night.
There are so many things that man cannot know. The bloom is the last light of the gods.
The sacred bloom traveled, and my dreams traveled with it.
It is unspeakable power. Whatever you dream, you will have.
It's too late to change what has happened. But not too late to change what will be.
It is from 2021, and it's kind of like a dark fantasy film, directed by Philip Gallat and Morgan Gallen King. It has quite a roster of stars behind it. The voice actors, we've got Richard E. Grant, Lucy Lawless, Patton Oswalt, Betty Gabriel, and Joe Manganiello. So where to begin with this story? So we've got this witch queen called Zod, and she has gone to a mountain and meets with this guardian. And they're talking about this flower that is bright blue called the bloom. And he is the protector of this flower, but she has said, I come from a place where this flower grows. And then she starts to tell him her backstory. She was captured by this gross king thing, and thrown into prison with Gal Sur, who is a scholar. She helps heal him with the bloom, and they both escape using the bloom's power. Gal Sur then kills her, takes the bloom, and eventually, after being locked up, he then uses the bloom's power to become even more powerful. And then there's a whole backstory about the guardians of the bloom. And yeah, it's, I think that's all I can do without confusing myself again. what do you think of The Spine of Night?
Yeah, so I picked these two because one is stop motion and one is rotoscope. And so they're two very different art forms of an animation. Like, rotoscope is, I guess, the best example. I mean, so a lot of the early Disney was rotoscope. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of Snow White and Cinderella and various other ones are rotoscoped. And what it is that it's live action that's then animated over. And so the most famous example recently was A Scanner Darkly, which is Richard Linklater's Philip K. Dick adaptation. But in the 80s, there was, when the 70s, there was Lord of the Rings like this. In the 80s, there was heavy metal. It's got a history. Yeah, so I watched The Spine of Night when it came out, and then I watched it again for this, and it taps a bit into what teenage me liked, which was fantasy epics, swords and violence, and some unprogressive views on gender, which thankfully I've grown out of. But yeah, I think as a 15, 14-year-old boy, I would have been all over this stuff. So I was a bit like, yeah, this is what I used to like. And also, I think it's this is extremely violent. This is an extremely violent film. And I think it's fascinating to watch an animation that is so violent, because I'm not sure it's always associated with the medium, a degree of violence, and it gives a freedom to it. So that's why we've ended up talking about these two, is because I think a different art form is being explored here. And I think it's also kind of just, for me, it's fascinating to me. Like, I think this film is fine, but if I was a teenage boy, I'd be like, this film is amazing. I love this film. And I kind of think it's nice to see growth within me and go, no, I probably wouldn't have done this film. But yeah, that's why I've ended up with this film.
Yeah, it was fine. I wouldn't be a big fan, because it's like, it's more fantasy, and I just I just not into fantasy all that much. It's funny, because like, when you think of animation, and especially this kind of animation, you think of like you said, like Disney and Lord of the Rings, but like, there are moments in this that was like, oh my god, like, that's so weird to see it through animation. Like, there's a scene where I think it's one of the prophets, he also gets the power of the bloom, and he's swinging around this thing that like cuts loads of people like in half, and it's really gory for an animation.
And like you said, oh, there's a person's jaw on the floor. Well, that's something.
And it's so shocking, because you just don't expect it to be portrayed. I mean, it is portrayed quite crudely. It's not like this animation has loads of detail. But it's still, at some points, it is still quite shocking. You're like, oh, Jesus. Like,
yeah, like Patton Oswalt's character gets his face burnt, and then you see his face all burnt. Yeah, I think for me, this film is, whereas I felt Mad God's slight repetition, I feel a lot of repetition with The Spine of Night. Like, I think the first 20 minutes is the film at its best. I think it's really effective at highlighting what it is out the gate. I think it's a really interesting art style it's got, and I think the first sort of third with Zod, or have I say their name, is the most compelling for me. And then it's sort of just this repetition of people come into contact with the bloom and die, and that's what the film is. And the film is sort of three or four stories connected, because it's the priest kind of priest figure goes through them all. And it's just in the same way they think Mad God is loosely about the repetition of war and violence, I think of this, of The Spine of the Night, I think they're basically doing the same thing each, which is that, you know, violence and war and the bad side of life just repeats itself over and over and over again throughout history. And that's just what this is. But yeah, I'm most impressed with this film at the start, and then it kind of doesn't do anything for me that else after that. It just is a series of violent acts, and I quite like, I enjoyed this vaguely steampunky flying rebels, I guess you'd call them,
the assassins,
like,
yeah.
And I quite like that it kind of like progresses its timeline from being castles and people who live within the swamp to this big tower and church to sort of a retro futurist vision of a medieval scape, where like there's airships and it's people can fly, and it's, but yeah, as a film, I think this is fine. And I think it's interesting as an example of rotoscope and of kind of like a clearer idea of an adult animation than I think Mad God is. I think Mad God is a creative's vision being played out in front of us. And as we said, we almost feel we shouldn't be watching this. I think this is far more like trying to hark back to a specific kind of film, which is like the fantasy of the 70s and 80s, kind of the Conan of the Barbarian of the worlds, like, you know, big muscles, large swords, people die with swords. Like, is it Joe, who's the, forget his name, the actor who's in Magic Mike 2, maybe, who is early on, like, the Lord's chief enforcer.
Oh, Joe Manganiello.
Like, and he's basically almost completely naked. He has like, you know, codpiece and stuff like that, but he's like rippling muscles. Everything is quite stylized, quite like the art style of whoever created the art covers for like Conan the Barbarian or John Carter, or for those kind of, this is very pulp.
Yeah, as soon as I saw Joe Manganiello's name attached to this, I was like, of course it is. He's such a big Dungeons and Dragons geek. Like, of course he's in this. I felt like it was a really extended heavy metal music video. Like, I wouldn't have been surprised to have heard Iron Maiden there in the background. Mm. Like, it's, like you said, it's just like a 14-year-old heavy metal boys fantasy.
Yeah, 14-year-old would have loved this. Would have been like, it'd be all over this. Watch it like 3 or 4 times in a weekend.
And I guess what I took from it was like an abuse of power, that, you know, you could have a gift bestowed on the world, but depending on whose hands it is in, you know, with the Guardians, again, they have like a cyclical nature as well. It all kind of depends on who comes across the bloom. Can they defeat the previous Guardian? And, you know, when they experience the power, do they feel it's too terrible for man? So it's very much, there seems to be three types of people who deal with this power. There's the Guardians who feel like it has to be kept and it's their responsibility to hide it from the world. Then you've got someone like Zod who uses it to kind of lead her people, but to also help people, and she doesn't abuse that power. And then we've got the men who do abuse it and, you know, try to take over the world. So yeah, it was an interesting kind of look at the different types of power and the different types of people who use that power and what they use it for. Would I watch it again? No. Probably not.
I don't think you need to watch it again, because, like, I mean, you asked me to watch Mad God for a second time. I still don't think I fully get Mad God. I still don't think I fully understand what is playing out in front of me. Mm. And I will gladly, well, not gladly, at some point I'll go back and watch it for a third time. To maybe the hope that I'll get it this time. Mm. I think with The Swine of Night, I think there's not any great any great mystery to it. I think because I understand it within the first 20 minutes, and that, like, it feels dated, which is harsh to say because it's only 2 years old, but it feels dated because even its attempt to have even men being the monsters doesn't stop, for example, Zod being basically naked for the entire film, or there being very few. I mean, there's not really any compelling characters in this at all. I can't really be like, there are no compelling female characters, because even like, none of the characters are particularly compelling. It's more just, I appreciate this for its, as an animation, and I kind of wish no one spoke, and I kind of wish that, it was just like heavy metal music played, and it was just like, we didn't get dialogue, no one spoke. We just saw people fight, we just saw people journey across this land. And I think that would serve it better, because the dialogue isn't very interesting or engaging. But for me, even though the visuals are a bit basic, they at least for me are interesting and compelling. Like the bits when we ever see like the vision of the giant eye in the sky opening up and the blue going between that, and there is like, there's some great background of this, like of mountainscapes. Like, I think the foreground is a bit lacking in detail, but the background's just a beautiful, and I think that's damning this with faint praise to say, but the backgrounds, think of the backgrounds, like they're the great bit about this. So I think like the horror here is less that this is, the horror fear here feels like horror adjacent for me. Like, I think it's horror because there's violence, and it's kind of vision of a the cosmos. It's very cosmic in what it's trying to do, but I guess because the dialogue gets in the way, it can't fully embrace being a full cosmic fantasy horror thing. And I think that's what it should be. And I'm most into, this is exciting. There is something out there. This is kind of terrifying, the idea that there's like this cosmic presence that we can't understand or even engage with. Like, that is interesting, but that's so fleetingly shown, and for the most part it's just men being terrible and women being victims. And I think that's always a bit problematic for me, that like, because I do think men are terrible for the most part, but I also think that if it's just a world where it's so basic as like men monsters, women victims, like, well, what about the middle?
Yeah, exactly. So would you recommend this to horror fans?
I think it depends where you come from. Less so, like, I think Mad God is worth watching because it's beautiful and horrifying and a vision. Whereas I think The Spine of Night is utterly fascinating for 20 minutes and then continues. And but definitely on a second watch, it becomes much more pronounced, the repetition in the second watch for me. So I think you should watch 20 minutes of this, and if you're enjoying it, watch the rest. And if you're like not that into it, you can turn it off. But I think like watching up into the bit where Zod dies is worth it. I don't think you'll be scared by this. I think I do find Mad God scary. I don't find this film particularly scary in the slightest, but I do think it is an interesting exploration of what rotoscope can do, because it is an art form that's been around since the foundations of animated pictures. There's been rotoscope, and so it's interesting from, I guess, from like an academically what is animation point of view. And interesting for 20 minutes, because there is an interesting vision here that's harking back to sort of pulp covers and 70s and 80s and sort of like a different era. But it scrapes a free star for me, because it's like, I admire aspects of it, but the whole is just sort of not altogether.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it to everyone. Like, if I knew that someone was a fan of animation, I would. I think it's quite endearing when they use... I like it when people hark back to methods previously. You know, I like that they've gone back and done, like, the rotoscope. I think it's really interesting, and I like that that is still being continued, much like stop-motion animation. Mm. It's never going to completely die out, because there's always going to be fans of that kind of animation. And I really like that. But yeah, it wasn't for me. I like the way that it's kind of, it forms, you know, horror isn't just one thing. It can be many things, and it can be a combination of genres. And, you know, that kind of, like, I kind of like that about it, but yeah, not for me.
And I must say though, every time, yeah, as you say, the stop motion or 2D animation or rotoscope, because the mainstream is so ubiquitously 3D CGI animation, I have to just give it a little celebration. But if you want good 2D animation, yeah, Cartoon Saloon, as mentioned, go watch them. They're not horror, but they're much better fantasy than this.
Yeah. So I kind of think I know the answer, but out of the two films, if someone was like, I want to watch an animated horror film, Russ, which one would I go for?
Oh, absolutely Mad God, and do it completely sober and with no with a level sugar intake, and be as clear-headed as you can, and then tell me what it's about.
Answers on a postcard, please. I obviously say the same. I think it's more straightforward horror. I think it's an interesting examination of what can be done using that medium. And how it's just gross, as you said. It's all icky and gooey, and, you know, it's not something you'd really expect from animation, but there it is. So that would be I'd go with Mad God as well. So what do you think is the future for horror animation?
So something like Mad God has a little bit taken off, so it has got a lot of interest and attention. So I think we have a streaming model that is in place. So it means that I think it's more likely that animated horror will still have a means to be shown. I don't think that the mainstream will ever fully embrace it. I don't fit because Disney have made several now animated close to horrors. They've made like The Black Cauldron. They've made, I guess you could Hunchback of Notre Dame a horror, because I mean, it's fairly horrifying. But I don't think there's ever going to be an animated horror, because like there was Monster House in the noughties, and that didn't make any money. Coraline did, but Laika kind of don't make money. So you've got to wait for like the Laikas to be the most mainstream of them. So I think we'll continue to have these kind of like animated horrors that pop out, that come onto streaming, that play well at festivals. I don't think we're ever going to get one that's sort of a four-quarter release. We're not going to get Illumination. Aren't going to do a horror anytime soon. And the most we can hope for in terms of mainstream animated horror is like the Hotel Transylvanias and the Addams Families, because they use the tropes and stylings of horror, but in an entirely humorous way. And the Hotel Transylvania films are I have a surprising soft spot for them. Like, as someone who doesn't particularly like Adam Sandler or that group of comedians, I think something like Hotel Transylvania is probably the closest we get to a mainstream, agreeable horror. But there's nothing scary about that. The scary one is Mad God, and you've got to wait for your next Mad God. Got to wait for your next Vision of Utter Terror to come out from stop motion or one of those formats.
Yeah.
And I always keep an eye out on the East Asian cinema, because they have an entirely different story to us. Their story is one that's much more incorporated. So keep an eye on them as well.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think we're going to have to kind of look towards those kind of animation cultures if we're really looking for adult horror animation. I mean, there's tons out there already. It would just be interesting to see if, like Western culture usually does, whether it's going to appropriate that kind of animated tradition now that it is coming onto our streaming services. I'm sure it will, because that's what Western civilization does. But yes, I'm very interested to kind of go further into the Japanese kind of anime culture. But I do love kids' horror animation, like you said, like Hotel Transylvania and kind of the Henry Selick kind of films. So thank you so much for coming on and talking. I didn't think we'd get as much out of it as we did, but look, here we are. Yeah. We did it. So before we go, what is your favorite horror film?
Well, thank you for letting me come and talk about horror. I love horror, and there's only so much I can shape my own podcast to cover it, because after a while it feels like getting blood from a stone or water, whatever the saying is. My favorite horror is, there's one horror film that stands out above all other horrors to me, and that's John Carpenter's The Thing. I watched it when I was about 12, and it was such an impactful watch. And I've watched it many times since. I have watched it in the cinema. I've watched it, every version of it that's come out. I've seen, I think it's a profoundly sad, captivating film. And I kind of love horrors where from the moment it starts, you are fairly confident that everyone is going to die on screen. Like, I think there's this sense from the opening beat of the soundtrack to The Thing that everyone is going to have a bad time, that there's not going to be a good time for anyone in that film. And I love it. Like, and unlike The Shining, which I also think really highly of, I can watch The Thing for comfort. I can pick it up and put it on and have a great time of it. Whereas The Shining, which is probably maybe the best horror I've seen, but not my favorite, is one that I watch very rarely because I find it utterly disturbing. And I'm a bit, I don't quite understand what I'm watching with the Shining, but The Thing, yeah. So it's John Carpenter's The Thing. I think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, you're quite a fan of sci-fi horror, aren't you? For someone who does, I feel like I always say this about things, I don't like it all that much, but for someone who's not a big fan of sci-fi horror, what is it about that subgenre that gets you?
So part of it is nostalgia for when I was a kid. Like, I didn't watch slashers growing up, so slashers have very little impact on me. Mm. I kind of admire horror that is big and sprawling and messy, and like sci-fi horror tends to be, that's like Halloween, Three Season the Witch, is this sprawlingly messy vision of Stonehenge and robots and masks that melt kids' faces into bugs. Jordan Peele's Nope is far too long, and the first half doesn't know what plot it is, but I think it's a wonderfully captivating thing. And it's just, I'm most scared by stuff that I'm not going to be able to understand or grasp. So folk horror terrifies me because the woods are utterly terrifying to me. Ghosts scare me because I have no idea what's next. I'm tangentially an atheist, but I am not, I'm not closing off the idea there's something next. And I suspect what's next is terrifying. And then with space, it's because it's expansive and huge, and we have no idea what's out there. We have no idea what is out there, and our experience of it is probably going to be a bad one. If we come across anything out there, it's probably going to not be a fun time. And then even something like sci-fi horror of the personal, so like something like Possessor from a couple of years ago, has never left my mind, because I think the vision of horror in that is so fascinating and so Yeah, I guess because I don't quite understand science myself, I was never good at science at school. Science kind of unnerves me because I can't quite explain it because, again, I was never that good at science. I was much more of a literature and film and history kind of watcher. So the idea that science can be used for nefarious purposes, both by us and by other things, gives me the chills. And that's not to deny, like, something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre scares me or Blair Witch Project. But yeah, I think it's the unexplainable and the unknowable that kind of keeps me awake at night.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So where can people find you on social media?
You can find me at Russ Loves Movies on Twitter whilst it's not on fire. I have Letterboxd and Instagram, but use them less effectively. I'm eternally sad that Twitter is in the state it's in because I like Twitter. Yeah, you can find me there. I post the kind of podcasts I pop up on. I pop up on a few now, which I always find a bit odd. And I write reviews for Moving Pictures Film Club and a few other places. And you can find my podcast on Twitter and Instagram at Adults2Pod. And yeah, come and find us there and you can find all the different shows we've done. We've just released at time of recording an episode on Marcel the Shell of Shoes On and the Super Mario Brothers, which could not be two more different films that are a fabulous statement of where animation is right now.
That was my chat there with Russ Bailey about animated horror, and we talked about The Spine of Night and Mad God, both from 2021. So let me know what you think of this week's episode. Do you know what the hell is going on in Mad God? Drop us a line. Let us know on Twitter at @what_scream or on Instagram @whatascream. You can also find me on Letterboxd, and don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on whatever platform you are listening to me on. I hope everyone is doing good, enjoying some horror, I guess. That's all I could hope from listeners of a horror podcast. And yeah, don't forget to stay horrific. Goodbye.